Mr. Livingstone is a vice president of Global Options, a risk management company that frequently works with government agencies.
Today I'm going to discuss threat analysis that Global Options conducted in 2003 on threats to America's medical supply system. And as far as we know, this is probably one of the first comprehensive threat assessments, and I'm going to report on the findings from the analysis. And if time permits, there's a second part to the presentation, which looks at the growth and the impact of website drugstores. In order to look at some of the threats from terrorist attacks, we had to look at the proliferation of drug websites. And following that, we have conducted several additional investigations. And there was some interest in learning some of the findings from that analysis. Before I begin, I'd like to give just a little bit of background about Global Options. We're a risk management company in Washington, D.C. We have conducted numerous threat assessments. I was involved in putting together the first threat assessment for the Department of Energy for the nuclear materials at civilian sites in Russia. After 9/11, we conducted the first threat assessment for the district's emergency management agency. And then last year, we were asked to put together an analysis of potential terrorist threats to America's medical supply system. I think everyone realizes that America is a target, but there are changes going on that are changing the dynamics of the threat. So terrorists are seeking not only new targets, but they're seeking innovative ways to attack America. Until 9/11, Al-Qaeda primarily attacked Western targets using large explosive devices. The attacks against U.S. coal, you might recall, it was a very large explosive device on a small boat that was rammed into the USS Cole. There also were the truck bombs against the U.S. embassies in East Africa. 9/11 was the first successful mass terrorist attack, and I use the term successful. In the mid-1990s, there had been a plot to put bombs aboard about 10 different airplanes and have them explode while the planes were all flying across the Pacific to their destinations. Al-Qaeda also had considered that at that time putting explosives on a small airplane and flying the airplane into the CIA. And since 9/11, with some of the reports by the different commissions, we've learned that actually initially the Al-Qaeda was had planned to have attacks both on the East Coast and the West Coast. They were going to target some of the large buildings in California and also had planned to make the attacks in New York and in the Pentagon. And Bin Laden had made a decision to limit the size of the attack. More recently, we see a new innovation in some of the attacks by Al-Qaeda. No one had been paying much attention to trains as a potential target. So we're looking at other potential targets like ports or trying to secure our airports. Al-Qaeda seems to be one step ahead of us. They placed numerous bombs aboard the Madrid train, and then they used remote communications to explode the bombs. So it reveals the innovation that Al-Qaeda is undertaking to try to find new and more dangerous potential ways to attack the West. Al-Qaeda historically has used these explosive bombs, but they also had, at the same time, have been trying to develop and weaponize different chemicals or poisons to mount attacks. Such a threat is not new. In the early 1990s, Aum Shinkiro, they funded a laboratory. About $1 million was spent to develop the laboratory. There were several people brought in who had graduate degrees. And there were attempts to weaponize anthrax, weaponize botulism, weaponize sarin. They were unsuccessful. The most noted attack occurred in 1994 when sarin was brought aboard the subway in Tokyo. It wasn't anything sophisticated. Sarin was contained in plastic containers. They poked holes in the containers, and the sarin wafted into the subway cars. 12 people were killed. Hundreds were wounded, taken to hospitals. There is abundant evidence that Al-Qaeda is seeking to develop the expertise to carry out a chemical or poison attack against the United States. We know from documents that were collected from the training camps in Afghanistan that they had training manuals to teach how to manufacture different poisons and poison gases. They conducted numerous experiments. You might recall in 2002, a videotape was made public of a dog that was in a cage that was suffocating from some agent. Authorities suspected it was cyanide. And then later on, in hearings in Los Angeles, Ahmed Rasim, he was the Millennium Bomber who was captured while trying to cross into the U.S. to plan the attack at the L.A. airport. He later was very open in discussing some of the training that he had received at the camps in Afghanistan. And he confirmed that Al-Qaeda had spent a great deal of time testing crude chemical devices, and one of them was cyanide and sulfuric acid. So based upon the same documents, based upon some of the debriefings, authorities believe that the level of knowledge by Al-Qaeda is not great. They explain it's probably at the level of a college graduate. And that's the reason you see today some attempts to mount attacks, but they're not terribly sophisticated at this time. The first attempted cyanide attack by Al-Qaeda occurred in early 2002. Italian police arrested four Moroccans for plotting to mount an attack against the U.S. Embassy. Months earlier, there had been intercepts collected by authorities in Italy, and they had got a tip-off that there was going to be some attack. There was a secret cell in Milan talking to a secret cell in Germany. The head of the secret cell was Sami bin Kamayas. He was a Tunisian living in Milano and was considered the ringleader. He had graduated from the terrorist camps in Afghanistan. In one of the intercepts, he's recorded as saying that he wanted to get permission from bin Laden to mount a terrorist attack against the West. In quote, he said, "I don't need an army, just two people with brains, training, and nothing to lose. They spread the gas and say goodbye." The police raided the apartment where the Moroccans were staying and discovered 4 kilos of potassium ferrocyanide and 22 pounds of firecrackers. And it appears that the terrorists were going to take the firecracker powder, combine it with the potassium ferrocyanide. It would heat it up and turn it into a toxic cloud of a gas. And maybe some of you scientists here know more about the possibility of that actually occurring, but in the news reports that have discussed it, that appeared to be how the attack had been planned. And it was an idea hatched by a Libyan who had evidently tried the experiments and transferred the information to the cells in Italy. The terrorists had been able to gain access into the sewer system in Rome, and there were large tunnels leading to the embassy. The embassy tunnels were normally protected by 3-foot-thick walls of concrete. The terrorists had actually drilled through one of these walls and was getting probably near to mounting the attack when the authorities interceded. The police also raided. The police aren't certain exactly how they would have gotten the cyanide into the building. One of the speculations was that there was a vent somewhere near the edge or underneath the building for some of the ventilation, and they were just going to take the weapon, put it underneath the building, and the cloud would wave up into the building. About 6 months later, the French intelligence reportedly uncovered some details that Al-Qaeda was going to plan a series of attacks against the West using cyanide and ricin. The information was passed along to the British intelligence and other Western powers. And soon thereafter, authorities in London uncovered a plot to attack the city's subway using pressurized canisters of cyanide. For months, reportedly, intelligence had been monitoring the movement of secret cells in London, and the militants would be traveling from different locations, potentially looking for places to mount the attack. The police subsequently raided the apartments of the militants. They found a laboratory, chemical manuals, protective laboratory clothing, and forged documents. In January of 2003, Scotland Yard conducted a series of raids in the suburbs of London. And soon thereafter, they arrested 13 militants from North Africa. And they discovered a makeshift laboratory to produce ricin, which you've heard a lot about, I guess, in some of the previous presentations. There's speculation that the terrorists planned to poison the food of a nearby military base where one of the militants was working, but no one really knows exactly where the attacks were planned. A couple months later, in March 2003, the French discovered traces of ricin in the railway station in Paris. And then most recently, in April 2004, the police in Jordan uncovered a plot by Islamic militants to use cyanide in attacks on embassies and government buildings in the capital, Amman. So there is a consistent progression of attempts by Al-Qaeda to mount a chemical attack using poisons. Other terrorist groups have also tried to increase the lethality of attacks by combining different chemicals with their bombs. Suicide bombers in Palestinian suicide bombers have taken rat poison and drenched it on some of the shrapnel that often is packed around the explosives. The victims that survive basically bleed to death because rat poison is an anticoagulant, and so they just bleed to death after an attack. Evidently, Palestinians have also tried to combine pesticides with certain bombs, but the heat from the explosives usually burn away the pesticides. So in summary, terrorists are seeking to increase the level, I guess I'm ahead of time, are seeking to increase the level of violence. The initial attacks appear to be very rudimentary. They tried to do things that are comparable to what happened in Tokyo in the past. You know, very, very simple type of devices. Put cyanide in a canister, combine it with firecracker powder. There's even some discussion that the terrorists wanted to put cyanide inside tomato cans, and you'd open the can and somehow it would have gas inside and you would die from the inhalation. In the assessment that we conducted at Global Options, we were asked to look at other potential scenarios, and one was the possible attack of putting poisons in pharmaceuticals. We're tasked to analyze the threat, and what follows are the results of the examination. Oh. And I guess I'm ahead of myself. This is one last cell I wanted to talk about. This is information that was not substantiated beyond a news report that was in the New York Times. William Safire, the columnist, wrote that there had been a laboratory set up in northern Iraq in the Kurdish area to weaponize poisons, and specifically cyanide. And if you believe the report, there had been an effort to try to put cyanide with a face cream, probably with some DSMO that would help the toxic penetrate through the skin. And then they would distribute that to the West. You put the face powder or face cream on, and it would kill you on contact. I haven't found any other information to substantiate this, but it shows the type of weapon that could be created by Al-Qaeda, and that they're thinking very innovatively, and they're thinking of new ways to mount attacks. So we looked when we started to think, what are the potential threats to America's medicine supply system? We broke the threat down into three different levels. First, there's the threat that terrorists are producing and selling harmful drugs. Then there's the threat that terrorists will raise funds from producing drugs and use that money to mount terrorist attacks. And the third and the most frightening threat is from combining poisons with pharmaceuticals and introducing them into our medicine supply system. So I'll look at each of the threats in more detail right now. The first threat, terrorists producing and selling harmful pharmaceuticals. There are reports that link terrorists to narcotics trafficking. Organized crime is very involved in narcotics trafficking, and as state sponsors of terrorism have pulled back their funding, you see terrorist groups aligning themselves with organized crime. Terrorists are more likely to produce drugs that are substandard or harmful. If you look at their ability to have suicide attacks with aircraft into large structures, you know, creating harmful drugs is not something that I'm sure they're going to lose sleep over. And there's also a threat to have them in the process. It creates uncertainty in the marketplace. So we don't want terrorists known to be fabricating counterfeit drugs and distributing them into the pharmaceutical arena. There's some evidence that's been made public that they're already involved at this level. An FDA warning letter released in 2001 said that the internet is a major source of sales of counterfeit finished drugs, with sales going into the pockets of some terrorist groups in the Middle East. Now, to the extent of how much money is being potentially funneled into terrorist groups, I haven't found any additional information. In fact, the issue hasn't been really examined in detail by either the CIA. There's very little attention to this issue in Homeland Security. So some of this information is coming from open sources, some of it from discussing issues with different people in government. But it's very difficult to get a lot of clear information about exactly what might be happening. The second threat, terrorists raising funds from pharmaceuticals for attacks. And there is quite a bit of information in this area. Money is the mother's milk of terrorism, as my brother has often said. Until 9/11, law enforcement in the United States didn't pay much attention to these large-scale scams, either coupon scams, cigarette scams. There are ways that oftentimes organized crime has raised money, but it's also ways that you see terrorist groups trying to raise money for their operations. It's estimated that in the United States, these scams generated anywhere from $20 to $30 million annually. Terrorists have long been involved in counterfeiting goods to raise money. The IRA reportedly was generating $2 to $3 million annually from duplicating or counterfeiting videotapes and audio cassettes. And why would they be involved in this and not something else? Fairly simple. The penalty for armed robbery could be life in prison. And if you're caught duplicating videotapes, it might be 1 or 2 years in prison. One of the first terror scams in the U.S. was uncovered in the late 1980s. And it involved the nephew of George Habash, who is the leader of the Palestinian Liberation Front. And they were operating a very large-scale coupon scam in the United States. Now, it doesn't seem like you can make much money with a coupon, but if you have thousands and thousands of coupons and you turn them in, you can generate a substantial amount of money. So the terrorists had organized a very large network. They would go out and purchase newspapers or collect newspapers that were never sold, magazines that were never sold. Recyclers, they collect materials that were never distributed to the public. They cut out the coupons, and then they artificially age the coupons, and then they have different storefronts that are participating in the scam who will redeem the coupons for money through clearinghouses. And it's expected that the terrorist groups have often used this scam and collected a large amount of money. The Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman, he was the mastermind for the terrorist attacks against the trade centers in 1993. He also was involved in t-shirt counterfeiting. Prior to the Atlanta Olympics, they had generated, they produced over 100,000 counterfeit t-shirts that the FBI discovered in a warehouse. So it's big business if you have it in a large-scale operation. And these are ways that the terrorists were generating funds to support their operations. Another scam involved the cigarettes. Very simple. If you purchase cigarettes in North Carolina, which produces a lot of tobacco, the taxes are very low. But the taxes are very high in other places like Michigan. So the terrorists would purchase large truckloads of cigarettes in North Carolina. They'd smuggle them up to Michigan and sell them in the black market. They made 70 cents per pack for each purchase. And it's estimated that they illegally transported $7.5 million of cigarettes during the operation before it was disrupted. In this case, authorities have traced the sale of, or traced some of the money generated from this operation for the purchase of military equipment, both night vision goggles and mine detection equipment and some other military equipment. More recently, Hezbollah has been involved in the smuggling of drugs from Canada into the United States. In Canada, their laws have been much looser than the United States, especially in some areas. For a long time, pseudoephedrin was not regulated in Canada. It's a drug that is a component of drug medicine. So Hezbollah would purchase large amounts of pseudoephedrin. They would smuggle it across the border and take it to clandestine labs operated in the United States by Mexican organized crime to produce methamphetamine or speed. When the operation was disrupted, 136 people were arrested in 10 different states. Asa Hutchinson, then head of the DEA, said the case was, quote, the first direct connection between drug activity, street sales in the United States, and funding terrorists overseas. The most disturbing evidence of terrorist groups getting involved in pharmaceuticals occurred in the early 1990s. Two members from the IRA traveled to Florida and set up a laboratory for $60,000 to produce a fake anti-parasitic drug for livestock. It was a new drug that had come onto the market. There was a high premium for the drug. The drug would be purchased in a clear vial, so it was very difficult to know what the contents were. The terrorists produced or purchased vials, stoppers, caps, all from U.S. manufacturers. They had counterfeit labels printed on a farm in Ireland. They would add some slight chemicals to water to fill up the vials, totally counterfeit. And it's estimated that over 700,000 cattle were injected with the fake drug before the operation was uncovered. What had happened is Merck had kept track of the declining sales and didn't know why the sales were declining, and launched an investigation which led to the discovery of the lab. The third threat, and the most frightening threat, is terrorists mounting an attack with poisoned pharmaceuticals. Now, there's no evidence that any terrorist group has considered such an attack, but I don't think it is beyond the realm of possibility. And there's a trend in the process that you see them getting closer and closer to this potential inevitability. An attack on the drug supply would create widespread fear and panic in the United States. And if you look at what they've done in the past, they've poisoned food supplies, so it's not a stretch in the imagination to also poison the pharmaceutical supply. In the 1970s, Palestinian militants tainted fruit that was produced in Israel, and the fruit had been distributed throughout Europe, and it led to a devastating effect for Israel. All the Israeli produce was pulled off the marketplace. And it was a very simple operation. The terrorists displaced mercury into some of the oranges and grapefruit. They're discovered, and then the people were understandably frightened, and no one would eat any Israeli fruit for quite some time. There was also another similar incident in the early 80s, and there was a purple dye displaced into the fruit. Authorities misunderstood what the threat was. There was a recall of all the Israeli produce and disrupted the marketplace with a very simple type of attack. We all might recall that in 1982, there was a very simple attack using Tylenol, and at that time capsules that would be easy to pull apart. Cyanide was placed in the capsules, and they were distributed to stores in the Chicago area. 7 people were killed. After the attacks were discovered, Johnson & Johnson pulled 22 million bottles from the shelves. It cost them over $100 million to reintroduce the Tylenol. And it also led to the enactment of new anti-tampering legislation. In our threat assessment, we looked at various scenarios on how an attack could occur in the United States. And one of the methods we came up with was that terrorists would combine cyanide, which they are trying to weaponize, with an aspirin, with Lipitor, with any possible drug. They would then smuggle it into Canada, or they'd smuggle it into Mexico, and then take it across the border and introduce it into our medicine supply system. And many of you may think that our supply system is very well regulated and the FDA controls drugs very closely. At certain levels, that's true, but in other levels, it is not true. The wholesale distribution system in the United States is horrendous. Each state has authority and regulates their own wholesale distributors, but there's no national regulation that controls all the different wholesalers. And what's happened is places like in Florida, for $400, you could make application to become a wholesaler. There would be no due diligence. You could even have a criminal record in an adjoining county, and it was never detected. So anyone can become a wholesaler. And I believe a lot of organized crime groups have become wholesalers, and it would be very easy for a terrorist organization to become a wholesaler. So it's very easy to introduce potentially counterfeit drugs into the United States. And some of these drugs will change hands from one wholesaler to another wholesaler 9 times before those drugs ultimately end up on the shelves of a pharmacy. In the late 80s, the government, Congress passed legislation to require what are called pedigree papers. That's supposed to keep track of the chain of control of the drugs that are produced. So the manufacturer will have a pedigree paper. When they sell the drug to the wholesaler, they will have a pedigree paper and on through the chain, so you can trace back the origin of the drug and find out if there's any foul play in the distribution of the drug. The problem is you can counterfeit a pedigree paper. This is a actual counterfeit that was generated on a PC, and who knows if it's authentic or not. The law that was passed in the 80s never was fully implemented, and today Congress doesn't believe that it will be effective. So really we have no chain of control in the drugs in the United States. In the next attack scenario, terrorists would transport tainted drugs to either Canada or Mexico. And because there are large numbers of Americans traveling to both areas to purchase drugs, then you could potentially target Americans by just bringing drugs to those two countries and not even smuggling them into the United States. Mexico's pharmacological industry is largely unregulated. Millions of Americans travel across the border regularly to purchase prescription pharmaceuticals, which are available over the counter. In Tijuana alone, there are 1,400 pharmacias. That is a huge amount. And there is some evidence that many of the pharmacias along the border area are operated by organized crime. In one study by a gentleman from the university in Texas, he found that as many as 11,000 Valium tablets were sold each day to Americans across the border from Nuevo Laredo, Mexico, to Laredo, Texas. So there's just a huge flood of drugs. All of the pharmacias are well noted. And if you go down to Tijuana, they'll have American signage. Their drugs are primarily for Americans, so it would be very easy for terrorists to sell some drugs. I'll just say this is Lipitor, it's authentic, and it's very difficult to tell a counterfeit from a real drug. Then Americans across the border purchase the drug, and there could be huge consequences if a large number of people were to purchase the drug. Canada is a little bit more difficult to assess as far as the opportunities to introduce counterfeit drugs. We tried to gather information on third-party assessments of their ability to regulate drugs and found almost no documentation. So while in the United States you will have congressional hearings, GAO reports, all kinds of third-party assessments, we could find nothing that would assess the Canadian drug supply system. We did find some media reports. One was by Tom Clark, who stated, "We know that there's a lot of counterfeit products making its way into Canada. But is it perverse? I don't know." There are only about 500 companies in Canada that are licensed to manufacture drugs and to distribute drugs. So it's very easy to monitor a small group of companies. Whereas in the United States, there are more than 6,500 wholesalers. They're regulated individually by the states, and they're very poorly regulated. So in one way, Canada probably has a better system for regulating drugs than the United States. The most worrisome threat is setting up a website to distribute a tainted drug. The terrorists would set up an internet drug site. Anyone can do that from any place in the world. They would create a customer base, and then they would take the tainted drug and use express mail, which is normally how drugs from outside the U.S. are distributed into the U.S. And you could target 1,000 different places in the United States at the same time. Imagine, you know, the type of fear that would be created from such an attack. Counterfeit drugs are very difficult to identify. The law that was generated after the Tylenol incident had some very rudimentary requirements. You have to have the flaps of a box sealed. Then there will be possibly a shrink wrap around the neck of a bottle, and oftentimes aluminum along the top of a bottle, and that's the protection to prevent tampering. But it's very easy to get the same equipment that manufacturers use to produce these medicines. And this is an example of the original and a counterfeit product in shrink wraps. You can't tell them can't tell the difference. So the public, if they receive such a product, there's just no indication whatsoever that there would be a potential attack underway if the terrorists were to send tainted medicines. The terrorists are experts at using the Internet. They use the Internet for fundraising. At least in the past, they used it very effectively. They use it to send communications from one secret cell to the other. They've used the Internet for propaganda and for carrying out attacks. So they're very knowledgeable about setting up a website. And that's the reason we later spent a lot of time looking at investigating internet websites to see what was going on, what is the possibility for an attack. If you want to buy drug manufacturing equipment, all you have to do is go to the internet and you can actually buy pill making machines on eBay. So if you are a terrorist organization, I want to be able to produce pills of any configuration, different colors, different sizes, just buy it off the internet. And then you can buy the same packaging equipment. Now, some of the protections with dyes, with holograms, might be more difficult to find, but you have a lot of counterfeiters that are able to get access to this technology, so you have to assume that terrorists are not that dummy, and they have a potential to get the same equipment. As I mentioned, there's no evidence that terrorists are manufacturing drugs, but it may not be long before they get involved in the process. To give you an example of what's going on outside the United States, there are tens of thousands of small manufacturing plants around the world. In India alone, there are 25,000 manufacturers. In Pakistan, there are more than 30,000 licensed druggists and chemists. And in Pakistan, you also have some of your most active terrorist groups. So it's not difficult to imagine that there may be a connection that's made. It could be happening today. If you try to find good information about possible counterfeiting outside the United States, you can find very limited information. It just has not been researched by any group. The UN has a committee that's trying to look at the issue, but they haven't even kept a database of counterfeit attacks that have occurred in the past, not from terrorists, but just counterfeit markets that are being exploited by different groups around the world. We did find one nexus which might give you an idea on how such a terrorist attack could evolve. In Karachi, Asif Ramzi, he was a leader of one of the terrorist organizations over there. He allegedly was the mastermind behind the murder of Daniel Pearl, the Wall Street Journal reporter. He supposedly sent over 35 mail bombs to officials in the city. He also was supposedly behind the bombing of the Sheraton Hotel that killed 11 engineers. I think that was in 2001. Ramzi rented a warehouse owned by Eros Pharmaceutical. And while he was preparing some weapons, there evidently was an explosion and he was killed and others around him were killed. But it gives you an idea how easy it is, potentially, to have terrorists get in bed with pharmaceutical makers and hatch a plot and attack the United States or any other country. So some of the conclusions from our report, terrorists are seeking new targets and greater lethality in attacks. I think that's obvious from looking at attacks prior to 9/11, and we can imagine other very devastating attacks in the future. But at the same time, they've been trying to develop chemical or poisonous attacks, and those have been very rudimentary. We might see cyanide placed into canisters, placed into a subway system in the United States. I don't think we're going to see a very sophisticated attack initially. Yesterday, there was a gentleman I had a chance to listen to who presented information to the panels or to the group here. And he was talking about botulism being placed into the milk in tankers that were distributed to the public. This is very, very sophisticated compared to the level of knowledge and operations that you've seen to date. Doesn't mean it won't happen, but I would be very surprised that they will jump from having no successful chemical or poison attack to a very sophisticated attack. I also think that it's easier to protect against something like that instead of going through and testing all the milk. All you have to do is put secure containers or lids on the ports that go into the into the tankers, and that way no one can get access into the milk. And that's what's happening with a lot of the other food produce in the United States. Trucks that are moving fresh produce, they have locks on them when they are moving from one point to another so people can't gain easy access to the food products. Mounting an attack using pharmaceuticals would be very easy to do. And you can see someone who had no knowledge, had no real abilities, was able to concoct the idea in 1982 of the Tylenol murders. Since then, there have been numerous extortion cases where you've had other people put cyanide, usually, with some drug, and they've killed people for extortion or used other, had other plans. But they, if you look over the 10-year period or 20-year period since Tylenol incidences, people have still been easily able to gain access to the drugs, put in a poison, and distribute it to the public. And then finally, an attack using poison drugs would create widespread fear and panic. And when we looked at different scenarios in the book, we didn't talk about all the ways that you could really complicate the process. But imagine if the first day you had a base of 1,000 people who took Lipitor, and you combined cyanide or strychnine with the drug and distributed it to 1,000 places in the United States. I mean, the panic would be unbelievable. The Tylenol murders created more media than any event prior to that time since the assassination of Kennedy. It was a huge, huge event. Now, let's say that the terrorists really want to get sophisticated, and the first day they send poison drugs with Lipitor, and the second day they send it with a heart medicine. Now, everyone that was taking a heart medicine is going to be suspicious about taking that medicine, and then they'll just stop taking the medicine. It's so easy to set up this attack because it's a remote attack. Secret cells that were operating in the United States, a large number of them have been identified. They've been identified in Canada. So it's becoming more difficult for Al-Qaeda to come up with a scenario so they can either put a large bomb in our backyard or concoct some sort of attack that is going to be successful. Al-Qaeda is very patient in how they put together attacks. They usually spend 2 to 3 years planning an attack. The East African incidences, when they had the truck bombs attack the U.S. embassies, they spent months and months planning this. They had computers that with CAD computers where they laid out how the trucks are going to drive into an area, where they're going to park, how the whole event's going to be planned. Most of the Al-Qaeda operatives, they were trained in a military style. If you look at the materials from the camps in Afghanistan, they're military manuals that they use for training. So these are folks who aren't terribly bright. Most of the operatives are young believers. They're primarily men. They're in their late teens, early 20s. They're not terribly sophisticated. They're not well-educated, but they're believers. And they're willing to give their life for what they believe in. So you have to come up with some scenario that these guys are going to be able to come into some area and surveil whatever the target is and plan the attack and make it successful. And it's not that easy given what you have to work with. So that's the reason I think since 9/11 we haven't seen a lot of attacks, because it's not that easy. But assume that if they are going to be successful, they will spend the year or 2 years or 3 years to come up with a very large attack. When we finished the threat assessment, we provided a copy to Homeland Defense. And some of this information is going to be a little outdated, but I talked to the one person in Homeland Security that is involved in protecting the healthcare infrastructure in the United States. The one person, and she is a very talented lady, but I think it's very difficult for one person to provide the protection that's necessary. I also have been interviewed on different media programs, and a representative from Homeland Security said they don't think it's a threat because they hadn't seen any literature that talked about using drugs with pharmaceutical products to mount an attack. But there also hadn't been any manuals or hadn't been any discussion about putting bombs on a train and using remote control systems to have multiple explosions to destroy the train. The pharmaceutical industry, they also haven't organized to try to deal with this threat. Some of the other industries in the United States, like the energy industry, transportation industry, they have set up partnerships with the federal government, and they share data, they try to come up with possible scenarios, they try to come up with crisis management plans to protect the public. To date, nothing has been established by the pharmaceutical industry to deal with this potential threat. All right, I think we still have some time. I'd like to now switch gears and talk about internet drugstores. In order to understand the threat, as I mentioned, we had to spend a lot of time looking at what's going on. And in that course, we conducted several other investigations of different internet sites up in Canada and some down in Mexico. So this will give you an idea of what is happening with the evolution of cyber pharmacies. To develop some trend analysis, we collected 432 internet websites, and this is about a year and a half old, so the data is going to be a little old. We wanted to find websites that had either Canada or Canadian in their domain name and had some reference to a drug. So, for instance, at that time, we were able to find 60 domain names that had Canada Pharmacy in their address. Everything from CanadaPharmacy.com, ACanadaPharmacy.com, AccessCanadaPharmacy.com. So there is just a proliferation of domain names that are trying to jump on the bandwagon that drugs are safe in Canada, and if you have a domain name that says Canada, people will believe that the drugs are safe. Out of the 432 names, about a third were inactive. So people purchase a name, they never hook up a website, and they just have the name just is out there, but nothing has happened. There's no website connected to the name. Out of the 433 websites or domain names, 97 likely originated in Canada. Sometimes it's very difficult to find out where the websites are located. 125 of the websites actually originated in Canada, in the United States. But they had Canada in their domain name because they hoped to find customers that are going to Canada seeking drugs, but actually the websites are in the United States. It's very easy to hide. You don't have to put information on who you are when you register a domain name. So 80 sites, who knows where they came from. We were able to find that three originated outside either the U.S. or Canada. Now, what's happened in the past, most of the internet activity originates in the United States and it moves up to Canada. It's in your Western countries. As times have passed, you now see poor countries developing the infrastructure. So you have internet websites now proliferating around the world. As I mentioned, some of this data is a little old, but you'll see the speed in which domain names are expanding. From the internet drugstores is basically a brand new industry that started in the late 1990s. They evolved from mail order drugstores. In Canada, you had different companies that would offer drugs by mail order. Those companies said, well, I think I'll try to sell them over the internet. It was the beginning of the process of being able to sell goods over the internet. So initially, you see a peak in 1999 of domain names from Canada. And then it used to be that you could only have domain names that had a .com or .net. There were a lot of restrictions in purchasing domain names. That process was expanded or opened up in 2001, which led to a huge proliferation of additional domain names. And since then, initially you wanted CanadaPharmacy.com, you wanted buyCanadianDrugs.com or something that had Canada and drugs in it. Since then, people now want to sell drugs specific to whatever the drug is. So if you look at Prozac, there are 400 domain names that have Prozac in it. There are close to 200 names that have Lipitor in the address. So you can buy Lipitor.com, buylipitoronline.com, cheaplipitor.com, elipitor.com, and it just goes on and on and on. And the reason that the drug stores are doing that is because when you use a search engine and you type in a drug, there's a likelihood that your website will come up on your screen. So if you put Lipitor into your domain name, it's going to move your potential website to the top of the list, and hopefully it will generate some sales. I think a lot of people realize that internet drug stores are completely unregulated. You can put any name to register a drug store, and you can register names now all over the world. As I mentioned, the websites are largely unknown. You don't have to say on the websites where the drugs originated from. You don't have to say that there's been a chain of custody of the drugs. Some places in Canada are better than others. In British Columbia, you actually have to have the pharmacy where supposedly the drugs originated. In other parts of Canada, where you have most activity, surprisingly, you don't have to have any information. Internet drug stores are developing these huge networks to try to gather customers. So initially, a pharmacy might have 6 domain names for selling drugs: Canada Pharmacy, Canada Pharmacy Now, Canada Pharmacy Cheap Drugs. So you'll have your first series of internet drug sites. And then you have what are called affiliates. And affiliates are anyone else in the world that has a server that is hooked to the internet. And what happens is these internet pharmacies will pay you to a commission if you put their software on their server and someone comes to your server and purchases the drug. So it's almost a pass-through. This could be, for instance, a server. It has the software that's similar to the initial pharmacy domain names. As a user, you don't really know where you're connecting to. It could be in the United States, it could be Mexico, it could be New Zealand. You'll see the website come up, you'll purchase the drug there, and actually you're an affiliate and the whole system is transparent. It goes up to the original pharmacy. They collect the order and then they distribute the drug. Some of these networks have thousands of different affiliates and domain names, so it becomes very difficult to know who's connected to who and where the drugs are coming from. As I mentioned, anyone can sell drugs on the internet. We found this one. The guy is Ray Pazin. He's a musician. He has a website to promote his musical talents. But he also sells drugs. And he registered the drugs at the Swizzle Inn in Bermuda. A lot of drug websites can be misleading, and these are some of the websites that we actually investigated. And this information is now a little old because the automatic link no longer occurs. But you used to type CanadianDrugsForLess.com, and I think that one's still operative, and it takes you automatically to BestMeds.com. Or I'm sorry, it's the other way around. BestMeds.com is in Canada. So you type Canadian Drugs for Less. The guy that runs the operation is in Alpharetta, Georgia. He doesn't ever touch the drugs. He just collects a commission. But the sale comes from BestMeds.com, and that's linked to a pharmacy up in Canada. A lot of times the affiliates don't want to tell you where the drugs are originating because they fear that you will then go directly to the pharmacy and not buy your drugs through the affiliate. Canada Prescription Depot.com is a website that we investigated. You type in that domain name, it automatically took you to pharmacy.com.mx. MX is for Mexico. And it was operated by a lady who is under bankruptcy. Her husband is a child molester. I'm not sure a lot of people would want to buy drugs knowing that information, but everything, you have no idea when you type in an address where you're going oftentimes. This is an internet website in Canada that sells codeine. We traced the product to a location in India. The person who operates the website is very open. His internet address is codeine by mail. He says he doesn't sell codeine. He is a personal shopper. You place an order through his website. He passes it on to India. India sends the package back to his operation in British Columbia, and then he passes forwards the package to the customer. And what's happening, and you don't have to go to a post office to sell drugs in Canada or to distribute drugs into the United States. You can buy packaged boxes. So one box is $2, one's $5, one's $10. What you have to do is put the drug in there, depending on how many drugs, put it in the post office, and it automatically comes across the border. What you have to do, and you declare to the customs officials that it's a personal health care product. Who knows what it is, but we purchased a lot of drugs from Canada. There was no oversight by the government on the distribution of the drugs. There are also poacher websites. If you forget to put the dot in on the domain name, you'll go to someplace completely different. And that's how they could also generate sales unsuspectingly. The most recent innovation is the internationalization of internet websites. This website provides links to drugs from over 150 locations around the world, in Canada, Mexico, New Zealand, Europe. So one site. You buy drugs just about from anywhere. And to give you an idea of what's happening, the internet is exploding. There are about 600 million people connected to the internet right now. Most people connected are not in the United States or in Canada. They're in Asia. There are 194 million users in China and India, and the total number of users by next year will be 1 billion. So what's happening? Drug spam. And I don't know if you receive many drug spam advertisements, but after conducting the analysis, I get hundreds of them. This is an example of the type of spam. You can buy coding online. I get these all the time. This one comes from China. The website on the right, if you click onto it, looks like a website. Could be Canada, could be the United States, but actually it's China. There are also problems now developing in Europe. This was a headline from January, and it's the first time that they've uncovered websites that have been selling counterfeit Viagra. So very quickly, some of the conclusions based upon our investigation. The internet is increasingly becoming a source for drugs. Cyber drug stores are proliferating, not just in the United States, but in Canada, Mexico, Europe, Asia, all over the world. There are an increasing number of people hooking up to the internet. An increasing number of people are more favorable to purchase drugs on the internet. So you just have this huge explosion of drug sales over the internet. And then a lot of times what you're doing is you're pushing your reputable operators outside the system. So if you operated in Canada and you had problems with authorities, they'll move to someplace else. A lot of your drug spam today is coming from Russia. And you can see as people want to avoid regulation, they'll move to Belize, they'll move to parts in Africa where there's almost no regulation, and you will be able to buy drugs any place, anytime, no drug or no doctor appointment necessary, and that's sort of the future of what's happening. And from a terrorist point of view, they're going to be able to take advantage of that trend. So very quickly, that's some of the information from our report. I don't know if there's any time for any questions. Okay, that's the hour. So thank you very much.